You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the film Who Framed Roger Rabbit is 30 years old, and an Appleton museum is celebrating with a new exhibit of classic animated stills. We'll talk to the collector about the showcase and the work that went into the movie. First, it's time for our weekly review of state news stories. President Trump came to Wisconsin this week for Foxconn's groundbreaking ceremony. He also continued his criticism of Harley-Davidson's decision to move some of their manufacturing operations overseas in the midst of escalating tariffs. Speaking of tariffs, Wisconsin's cheese industry is assessing what impact they might feel as a trade war heats up. And some Wisconsin lawmakers want to meet with a judge about the sentence given to a man convicted of several sexual assaults. Robert Menser is a statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. He joins us every week at this time. Rob, welcome back to the show.
Why, thank you.
Well, let's start with the president's visit to Wisconsin yesterday for the Foxconn groundbreaking. Talk about the event a little bit.
Sure, big week for Foxconn stuff. I mean, they say it's a groundbreaking, Rob, but I mean, they've been working on the construction has been going
official.
On for weeks at the place. But this is the politicians' big day. The president was there. Governor Scott Walker was there. Foxconn CEO Terry Goh. And they did all the, you know, pomp and ceremony politicians like to do on these events. They're shoveling dirt, they're unveiling, you know, models and renderings and talking up the economic impact of the project.
And we had WEDIC Secretary Mark Hogan on the show yesterday, and he'd been at the event, and he and I think the governor have been hitting the point hard, making the case that this isn't just southeastern Wisconsin, that companies on the supply chain and construction and so forth are going to see benefits around the state. That seems to be a big selling point that they're pushing here.
Yeah, they announced some contracts with a steel company in Merrill and some other, you know, other manufacturers around the state. So yeah, for sure that is the message. They're not wrong. Like there are effects that are going to be felt statewide.
And there's been some polling in the Marquette Law School poll showing not universal support, I think it's fair to say, for Foxconn, especially in other parts of the state. Rob, do you see this being a marquee issue in the race for governor in the state legislature this year?
Yeah, I think that the decision to make it a marquee issue was cast very shortly after the deal was announced in the first place. So, the results aren't real strong. There's a plurality of respondents in that most recent poll who were skeptical. 46% said they did not think that the deal would pay off for Wisconsin's economy. 40% thought it would. 13% did not know. I think that both Governor Walker and Democrats have placed their respective bets on opposite sides of that issue. And for sure, it's a central campaign issue.
And also the president, he was praising this Foxconn plant in Wisconsin. Also, I think this was at a fundraiser. He again criticized Harley-Davidson, one of the state's most iconic brands. Here's the president addressing the issue during that visit.
Harley-Davidson, please build those beautiful motorcycles in the USA, please, okay? Don't get cute with us. Don't get cute.
So talk us through the story of Harley-Davidson and dueling tariffs, Rob.
So, this stems from the Trump administration's announcement of new tariffs on steel and aluminum made outside the U.S. And what it means is new taxes on steel that comes from, you know, wherever, from Europe or Canada or wherever. In response to this, the European Union said that it would add a 31% tax on motorcycles that are made in the U.S. So in response to that, Harley said, okay, well, we're going to move some of our production overseas to avoid that tax for motorcycles that they want to sell in the European market. That is a rational decision for the company to make, but obviously it undercuts Trump's trade war, and Trump really does not like that. So, yeah, he made sure to mention that after. And the reason this is the context of it is he's been on a, you know, in a Twitter war with Harley-Davidson all week leading up to this big, you know, event in Wisconsin. He's fighting with one of Wisconsin's largest manufacturing employers.
And how have leading Wisconsin Republicans kind of caught in the middle here? How have they responded to all this?
Republicans don't like the tariffs by and large. Senator Ron Johnson has said so. Governor Scott Walker has said so, but it's like none of them want to like have a be in a frontal assault with the president. So they have made their views known. Conservatives tend to favor free trade policies. It is not that. So they're not supporting it, but also like no one really, you know, it's not like anyone's going out of their way in the Republican Party to fight with the president either.
And speaking of tariffs, there's concern now about how European Union, in particular, retaliatory tariffs could hit Wisconsin's cheese industry. I've also seen reports, I think NPR reported this, some Canadians avoiding American produce, I think including cheese. Talk about what Wisconsin dairy farmers and industry experts are worried about.
Yeah, this is the other significant tariff story. It has a serious, in some cases, devastating effect on Wisconsin cheese, Wisconsin dairy farmers. So, like a lot of American farmers, dairy farmers rely on international markets. So Mexico, in response to the same new taxes on steel and aluminum that the Trump administration declared, placed their own new taxes of between 15% and 25% on U.S. cheese. So in turn, that affects the price of milk. There are a lot of Wisconsin farmers then who are stuck dealing with those effects. So the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel interviewed an industry analyst who said that in the short term, Wisconsin dairy farms could be losing 20% of their income each month. That's serious. According to him, it's about a $75 million per month drop in revenues to dairy farms.
And I think I saw the statistic in that same piece, something like 90% of Wisconsin milk is destined to become Wisconsin cheese.
Right, that's right. Yeah, exactly. So if a buyer, international buyer, Mexico, whatever the market is, effectively raises the price of U.S. cheese, it has real ripple effects.
Talking to Rob Mentzer from USA Today Network Wisconsin, looking at some of the top stories in state news this week. Rob, we touched on this story last week, the sentencing of Alec Cook, and there's some response from lawmakers now. First, remind us of what happened in that case and the sentencing.
Sure. Alec Cook was a UW-Madison student, and he was a serial rapist. He was shown to be a repeat offender in court. He ended up pleading guilty in exchange for a number of drop charges, but even with the charges that remained, there were sexual assault charges against multiple women. And the prosecutors asked for 20 years, 19 and a half years in prison, and he got 3 years in prison.
So this week we've got 5 Wisconsin legislators and 2 Dane County supervisors expressing outrage about what they said was a far too lenient sentence given by Dane County Judge Stephen Elke. UW-Madison Chief of Police also expressed deep disappointment. Can you talk about some of the response you're seeing to this sentence?
Right. So this group of legislators, the UW-Madison campus chief, this follows last week. The state attorney general said the same, that he felt that the justice wasn't served in this case. So this is, there's a lot of political pressure being brought to bear on this case. It isn't for me to say what is or isn't right or the right sentence or whatever, but it is the case that we have a system where judges are insulated from a lot of politics, but not totally insulated from politics. Judges in Wisconsin are elected. They can be recalled. For better or worse, that is the system that we have where, the political appeals like this, there is some way that they can get traction.
And Rob, I want to turn to a story. This is one I hadn't seen much until you shared some of the reporting on this. Going back to Pearl Harbor, the attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, one of the many Americans who lost their lives there were a Navy pharmacist from Wisconsin, a pharmacist mate John Schoonover, originally of Port Edwards. Can you tell us this story?
Right. Yeah, John Schoonover from Central Wisconsin, from Port Edwards, died in the bombing at Pearl Harbor, and he's been buried. He was buried in a mass grave site in Hawaii. So it was known that he died in the bombing, but they never specifically identified his remains. So there have been a lot of advances in DNA testing, DNA analysis, and more recently the Department of Defense issued a mandate that remains at these sites should be exhumed and should be analyzed. And this led to the identification of Schoonover's remains. And this week he was laid to rest at a naval cemetery near the Pensacola Naval Air Station, where his son, who was 4 years old when he died and now lives in Florida, says that he'll be buried as well.
And his son went in the Navy himself.
Yeah, his son had 45 years in the Navy, so it was a family tradition. And he said that it was a lot of, he had a full, military funeral, honor guard. He said that it brought real closure to him as well.
We'll leave it there for this week. Rob, good to talk with you.
Thank you.
That's Robert Mentzer, statewide living and storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin. He's based in Wausau. He joins us every week at this time to take a look back at some of the top state news stories. The film Who Framed Roger Rabbit is turning 30 this year. It was the second highest grossing movie of 1988, and it's still considered a landmark for the way it combined hand-drawn animated characters and live characters acting together on screen. The Trout Museum of Art in Appleton is celebrating that legacy with its new exhibit, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? The Art of Classic American Animation. The exhibit runs until August 31st and features hand-painted cells from Roger Rabbit and drawings by classic Looney Tunes animator Chuck Jones. Bill Heater is an Appleton native. It's his collection on display at the museum. Bill, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for the interest in the collection and interest in the Trout Museum.
Yeah, what got you interested in collecting these classic animation cells?
Well, actually, when I was a little child, I was walking down the street and an Acme face fell on my head. I'm sorry. That was a cartoon. Sorry. It actually started. There's two parts to this. It started when I was probably 7 or 8 years old, and I would come home from school over the lunchtime, and this is in Appleton, and I would be watching Looney Tunes cartoons on the local TV station. So I'd have my little peanut butter sandwich and a glass of milk, and I'd go out and watch these cartoons over the lunch hour. And my dad would tell me, if that big old rooster ever comes on, referring to Foghorn Leghorn, he said, let me know, and I'll come out and have lunch with you. So there would be times when good old Foghorn would be on and my dad would come out and watch the cartoons. And those are just great memories for me. And so fast forward about 20 years, I was working for a gift wrap company and party goods company in Appleton called Art Fair. And I was doing some licensing and we were trying to get the Warner Brothers license. So I was on the phone constantly to the people out there trying to make the connections and get the license. And that didn't happen, unfortunately, but it did allow me to connect with other people in the animation industry, and that kind of refed my enthusiasm. So I guess if you had to sum it up, it all goes back, I can blame it on my parents, like a lot of things, right?
Let's talk about what a cell is. People use that word. It's C-E-L, right? When I look at an animation cell, what am I looking at?
Well, it's basically, it was in the old days, meaning pre-World War II, was a piece of celluloid. And it's typically 10.5 by 12.5 size. It's got peg holes at the bottom. And the way it works is there's an artist who does a general drawing, and then you lay this clear cell, just short for celluloid, over it, and they'll ink the outline of the character or the pose or whatever. Then they'll flip it over, and it will go to a separate team called the painters, simple ink and paint, and they will flip and paint on the back side. So the ink is on the front, the paint is on the backside, and it allows it to be filmed in better clarity, and there's no distortion of color or texture. So that's what they did pre-World War II. Post-World War II, they went to acetate. So even though they call them cells, it's no longer celluloid, it's done on acetate. But traditional animation was still done the same way. You had inkers and painters and people who would draw the characters, rough sketches, and then the finished sketches, and then it would be filmed. So what you're looking at in the Roger Rabbit exhibit are the actual cells that appeared under camera and on the screen that were inked and painted by the artist.
And how many cells would make up, I don't know, a second of animation?
Well, typically, I mean, classic animation, meaning Disney and Warner Brothers in the 40s, 50s, early 60s, would be 24 cells per second. So you can just imagine, you know, an hour and a half cartoon, for example, how many pieces of art there are to that. But then in the 1960s, you know, when television came into play and they had to cut budgets, they really knocked it down a lot. And there's many cartoons that were done with six or eight cells per second. So that's why you had kind of the herky-jerky motion of the 60s and 70s cartoons, or the characters wouldn't move because that way they just have to animate the lips or the arms or whatever. So it's just a way to produce them much more cheaply.
Now, a lot of the material display on the Trout Museum of Art from your collection is from the movie Who Framed Roger Rabbit? And I think a lot of people, I wondered this as a kid, you've got Bob Hoskins and other humans interacting with Roger Rabbit and other cartoon characters. Can you talk about what you have in this exhibit and what it tells us about how they had, you know, people and cartoons acting together?
I mean, it was an amazing thing, and there's a number of things that made it so fabulous, at least in my opinion. One was, just as an example, Bob Hoskins, who was a character, Eddie Valiant, never knew what Jessica Rabbit looked like until well after the movie was completed. So he was either acting against characters who were eventually painted over or to people off stage. And a lot of the props were these mechanical contraptions that had to wave, you know, knock over chairs, knock over pictures, wave guns through the air. And it was all done through these pretty sophisticated mechanical maneuvers, almost like maquettes are operated, where you've got strings and wires and everything moving them. And then the animators had to animate to the movement of those props. I wish one of the things, I have a few cells where it shows the actual animation and the live behind it, so to speak,
wow,
the live props or whatever. So if people go through the exhibit and look closely, they can actually see behind the cell and see the actual prop that was used that the character or that the actors were acting against. It's kind of fun.
We're talking to Bill Heater. His collection of classic animation cells is on display this summer at the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton. Bill, you also have, you mentioned earlier, those Looney Tunes ones. You've got some classic cells from, I think, animator Chuck Jones. Is that right?
Yeah, it is. Chuck, to me, was the quintessential Warner Brothers director. There's probably five famous Warner Brothers directors, Tex Avery and Bob Clampett and Bob McKimson and Chuck and Friz Freleng. And a lot of these characters, especially Tex Avery, was about exaggeration of characters. So the eyes would bulge out or the characters would stretch or whatever. Chuck was just the opposite. He was all about subtlety. So whereas in one scene, one director would animate it and the character would act one way, in Chuck's case, Bugs Bunny may just raise his eyebrow or may just look at the audience. And I love the subtlety of the way Chuck handled that. The unfortunate thing is Warner Brothers, and really throughout animation history, they didn't have a lot of respect for the art. And in the early 1960s, I've heard two versions. One was Jack Warner, and the other was one of his accountants decided this art wasn't of value at all. So they ended up disposing of all of it. Thousands and thousands of animation cells and pieces of art were destroyed. So as Chuck was touring colleges and into the 70s, his daughter Linda suggested he start recreating the famous scenes from his cartoons. And that was about the time I was starting to do the licensing. So I connected with them. I bought my first cell, a limited edition. I have to tell you, Rob, my hand was shaking when I was writing that check because I was a college student fresh out of school, I should say, and I didn't have a lot of money, and here I'm spending $100 on this cartoony picture that I'm going to hang on my wall. But one led to two, and two led to four, and Chuck kept releasing them because he had so many, you know, really terrific cartoons. There were plenty of scenes that he could recreate, and the collection just kind of mushroomed from there.
You just talked about cartoons as art. You said they weren't treated as art back in the day, the art and the animation. But now you've got your collection. It's at an art museum. Are we taking this art, this animation, more seriously now?
I think it's a two-edged sword. I think people who grew up with this kind of animation appreciate it. They understand it. And frankly, they're looking at it as a collectible because there hasn't been a full-feature, hand, traditionally done animation cartoon since, I think, 2012 in the Disney's Frog and the Princess. And it's really moved to CGI, which is computer-generated graphics. And so I think younger people probably, they're so adept at the computer and they're so used to seeing the things on TV, they're all CGI. There aren't animation cells. So it's really not a collectible from that standpoint because it doesn't really exist in the same way. So I think it's a generational thing. And right now, I would say animation is starting to have a rebirth because people who saw the traditional stuff in the 50s and 60s and 70s are now trying to find the cells because they realize they don't exist anymore. They don't make this kind of art anymore. So I'm hopeful it'll continue to have interest. And that's why I give the Trout Museum a lot of credit because they're kind of at the forefront of getting this out in front of people and recognizing it as a legitimate and appreciated form of art.
That's a good place to leave it. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I appreciate it. I hope people stop by the exhibit, and thanks again for your interest, Rob.
Bill Heater's collection is on display at the Trout Museum of Art in Appleton until August 31st as part of the exhibit, Who Framed Roger Rabbit? The Art of Classic American Animation. Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy announced his retirement earlier this week, giving President Trump and Republicans a big opportunity and setting up a big confirmation battle. The vacancy gives Trump the chance to strengthen the court's conservative majority, potentially reshaping it for decades. Democrats are sounding the alarm, saying bedrock precedents like abortion rights are on the line. Here's Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer on the Senate floor this week.
This is the most important Supreme Court vacancy for this country in at least a generation. Nothing less than the fate of our health care system, reproductive rights for women, and countless other protections for middle-class Americans are at stake.
Charlie Jacobs is an associate professor of political science at St. Norbert College in De Pere. He's with us now to talk about the effort to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy. Charlie, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, do you think Senator Chuck Schumer was overstating things, or is this really that consequential an appointment?
It is consequential, but I think a little perspective is due. In essence, Democrats said about the same thing about Kennedy, because he was going to be a pivotal vote that was going to help sort of complete the Reagan Revolution and the transformation of the United States Supreme Court. And you have to remember that Kennedy himself was the one who upended conservatives' attempt to overturn Roe versus Wade and Roe versus Wade and eliminate abortion rights for women. And yet he and O'Connor and Souter worked with some of the liberals in order to sustain that precedent. So, you know, We can try to predict the way in which justices are going to vote, and we have lots of measures in political science and in other fields to try to understand that. But, you know, there's an old aphorism about where you stand is where you sit, and sometimes an individual who might wind up on the court might have views outside of that institution. But once they get in and they have to work collegially with eight other justices, the way they frame decisions and cases can change radically. So is it consequential? Yes. But I don't think right now we can say with any confidence that reproductive rights will end or the ACA will get overturned until we see who the individual is and how they're likely to work with the other justices on the bench.
And the goal, it seems, when a president of either party is picking a nominee, they probably want to lock down as best they can someone who's going to be as reliable as possible in the direction they hope. So how do they start, if we can use a Wisconsin phrase, sifting and winnowing from potential candidates?
Well, this is the kind of thing that happens in sort of the smoke-filled back rooms of the White House and has been going on even prior to the election of President Trump. I mean, staffers are working on these kinds of issues, and they have a good sense of who might be a good fit. Now, there are a number of dynamics that go into this. So right now for the Trump administration, it's what kind of political climate do we have? What's the public opinion on these kinds of issues in the context of the way in which Trump is governing at the moment, so that there are lots of things that they have to balance. And, of course, looking right now at some of the controversies that have erupted and the reaction from U.S. senators, even Republicans, I think the Trump administration is going to have to be pretty careful about who they pick so they don't lose any Republicans. I think there are some safer choices where they can achieve their conservative goals, and some there might be a little bit more risky, especially when you think about some of the women senators on the Republican side of the aisle.
Let's talk about procedure a bit. If the president picks someone who all of the slim Republican majority can get behind, there aren't Democrats, or the minority party doesn't have the kind of options it used to, right, in blocking a Supreme Court nominee.
Correct. I mean, the use of the filibuster against the United States Supreme Court justice is off the table now. So, in essence, the Democrats can run a couple of maneuvers here and there to try and delay the process. But ultimately, if Mitch McConnell and the Republicans work the rules of the institution that are right in front of them, they should have a relatively clear path, as long as they have the votes, to secure the nomination that is forwarded by President Trump.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College about who's going to replace Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, announced his retirement this week. You mentioned a couple of women senators seen as more moderate in the Senate Republican caucus. Yesterday, Senator Susan Collins, one of those, gave reporters a glimpse into what she wants to hear from a nominee.
I do get a sense from them on whether or not they respect precedent. And from my perspective, Roe v. Wade is an important precedent, and it is settled law.
What do you make of the role of Susan Collins and Senator Murkowski from Alaska as potential swing votes on this, or at least their influence on who gets nominated?
And again, I think more than anything, it's they're trying to use a little bit of leverage that they have to try to at least get the Trump administration to recognize that there is some quicksand that they could step into and really derail the whole process. So, you know, there is this odd kind of courtesy that goes on after a nomination, and they walk the nominee basically to every senator's office. And, you know, most senators do it as a formality. Some really dig in and plumb the ideas of these nominees. And I think what Susan Collins is saying is that might be too late for you. You better be seeking our consent about some of your nominees ahead of time, because we may not be so willing to acquiesce to whatever choice you make. So it's big signaling from Collins, and I think from others who have publicly spoken about this issue, just to make sure that the Trump administration knows it can be easier or harder depending upon how you want to treat this. If you want to bull rush us, that might not go so well.
Majority Leader Senator Mitch McConnell says he wants to have this thing in the bag by November, or by the fall, I should say, which means it would be done before the November elections. Now, the Supreme Court, I was looking at some numbers, at least in some polls, about 1 in 5 voters in the presidential election in 2016 said, yeah, Supreme Court justice, top issue for me. 50-some percent were Republicans, only 40-some Democrats. This was a voting issue for Republicans when they pulled the lever or punched the ballot or filled in the thing for Donald Trump. Is that something people are watching, you think, for this fall's election?
I think so. I mean, the issue of Supreme Court justice is in some of these what we consider fundamental or important civil rights has always been, or I would say at least from the 1980s on, has always been a really important issue for voters. A lot of these voters are often single-issue voters regarding things like religious liberties or abortion and privacy rights. So, yeah, I mean, it's going to be consequential for the president, and this also might not play well for Republicans in the Senate, and they're hoping to hold on to their majority. And yes, they may squeak through and be able to get another Supreme Court justice who was nominated by a Republican. But it may do significant damage to them if it's a wildly unpopular choice. So there is a balancing act here. I don't know how concerned President Trump is about that and whether or not he's willing to throw the senators under the bus or not. So we're going to have to kind of wait and see what kind of temperament this nominee will have and whether or not it's going to really affect public opinion in a big way.
Do you see this affecting elections at the state level? If Roe versus Wade is at play, that's a big if, but if people are looking at that, could it be an arguing point for Democrats and Republicans, hey, what happens at the state level matters now. An anti-abortion law, for example, could pass and be approved by the U.S. Supreme Court, so that that affects these state elections.
I think it can, because it's about protecting state rights or protecting women in states through state law rather than relying on this umbrella of constitutional protection. So certainly I think that this is going to accrue some benefits to Democrats who are running. It's just another arrow in their quiver to make the case to voters that Democrats are going to do a better job protecting your rights. Now, it's not going to resonate well all over the country, but I think among certain constituencies, it's something that you can really pound Republicans with if you're a Democrat.
Talking to Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College in De Pere about Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy's retirement and the effort to replace him. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how the confirmation process works? Do you have thoughts? What are you looking for in a nominee? Whichever side of big debates you're on, what do you want to see here? What are your hopes, your fears? How do you think it's going to affect elections in November? How it'll affect your vote? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with political scientist Charlie Jacobs from St. Norbert College, looking at the confirmation battle over Justice Anthony Kennedy's seat on the U.S. Supreme Court. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is the Supreme Court a voting issue for you? With this retirement announcement this week, what was your reaction? What are you hoping comes out of this? What are you fearing comes out of this? Call in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's good to have more or less identifiably liberal or conservative justices on the court with, you know, some variations there? Or would you like to see swing voters, people in the middle, moderates? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll go to your calls now. Michael is with us in Green Bay. Michael, hi.
Hi, thank you. I had agreed with the guest from St. Norbert in saying that I don't think that right now there will be a justice put forward or a candidate put forward that'll be so radical that even with the new votes of 51 to confirm it. But I think there's a large chance that they are going to put forward someone who is going to try and swing with their ideological agenda of the right and of a more conservative way. But I don't think that justices themselves should be judged based on their political leanings, but based on their character and their history as a judge.
Michael, thanks a lot for the call. Charlie, and I think there's a lot of talk about just weighing the judicial background of the nominee for a Supreme Court or lower court for that matter. But do the partisan politics still enter into it?
Oh, it certainly does. Most of the studies that we've done in political science recognize pretty clearly that the ideological predilections of a nominee are going to wind up being reflected in their behavior on the bench. So if you're a conservative Republican, you are more than likely going to vote in that direction. And that often leads you in your interpretation of the law. So it is very important. It's not an exclusive predictor. Look, they were calling Justice David Souter the stealth candidate because, well, we didn't know anything about him, but he looks like a rock-ribbed conservative, and he wound up being quite liberal on the bench. So you never know, but you know, aides in the White House right now are digging deep to determine whether or not they are going to be reliable conservative votes, whether or not they're good judges or bad judges or have good character or bad character. They are looking squarely at how they're going to vote politically and ideologically.
Thanks for that call. We'll go next to Peter in Madison. Peter, hi.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
So kind of going off of what was just spoke about. So, you know, my underlying problem with the whole Supreme Court conversations that's going forward is that we label these justices either a Republican or a Democrat or conservative or liberal, when in reality, you know, they're sworn onto the bench to interpret the law with no bias and you know, judge each case as they are without thinking about their own personal views. So I always think it's kind of funny when, you know, we think about judicial restraint and judicial activism. And you know, what I'd like to see is a truly unbiased, you know, there isn't one way or the other. They read the law and interpret it case by case and do the right thing by the people.
Peter, thanks a lot for that call. It is an interesting question, Charlie. We've got the U.S. Supreme Court with this nomination process, and we end up with judges we feel like are pretty partisan. We elect our judges in Wisconsin, and we have identifiably conservative or liberal or Republican-backed or Democratic-backed judges. Is there such a thing as a way to find nonpartisan judges?
It's quite difficult. And you know, Peter raises an interesting point and one that's very important. And I'll sort of quote John Roberts, who during his confirmation hearings, trying to sound very objective, said, "As a judge, I just call balls and strikes." So I don't know if there are any baseball fans out there like I am, but even with a little box up, when you're watching ball games on TV, you disagree with the way balls and strikes are getting called, and batters disagree with it. So we try to make these processes objective, but there's always going to be subjectivity. The manager, the batter, the catcher, the umpire are going to disagree about what's a ball and a strike. And we do the same thing when we talk about the law. The manner by which we decide to interpret it textually or using history or using sort of a living idea of the Constitution are going to produce different outcomes in cases. And so we often conflate those with the ideas of liberal and conservative, but the outcomes are generally either perceived as liberal or conservative, and that's what weighs down the process of decision-making.
Peter, thanks for that call. Charlie, I've seen some analysis, including from UW-Madison professor Ryan Owens in the Weekly Standard, saying, and now the closest thing to a swing vote you're going to have, assuming a more conservative Gorsuch-like appointment, is Chief Justice Roberts himself. He might be the most likely to switch sides now that Kennedy is leaving. What do you make of that?
If you look at the data, that's exactly the case. And quite honestly, Roberts is not that much more conservative than Kennedy is right now. We use this measure called Martin Quinn scores, and he's very, very close to what Kennedy looks like. And to sort of reinforce this idea that this matters quite a bit, you know, when you've got four people who are more conservative and four people who are more liberal, the person who is what we call the median justice, the one smack dab in the middle, is the one to whom all arguments are framed in Supreme Court cases. And so Roberts will really, it's like lawyers will be talking to one person on the court because the other votes are likely already taken up. And so Roberts has said repeatedly, and you see it in his work, that he is really concerned about the legitimacy of the court. So if he believes that the public is going to perceive the court as becoming too conservative or starting to implement two political points of view through the law, he may take on that Kennedy-like mantle and side more often than you would expect with liberals, merely because he wants the public to have confidence in what the court is doing as an apolitical institution.
Yeah, when it was Kennedy drawing all the attention, you know, the Roberts vote might not look so important. It might feel like there's a lot of pressure on you if you are viewed as the one overturning a major precedent. Just briefly, do you think that weighs on a justice?
Oh, I think it certainly does. I mean, it weighs on it, and we have to remember, these people also have egos. I mean, they're nine of the most important people, you know, in the legal profession. And so when all the spotlight is on you, I think there's probably trepidation because you're worried about offending a particular constituency. And trust me, Kennedy is disliked by conservatives and liberals alike.
We'll leave it there. Thanks to Charlie Jacobs, political science professor at St. Norbert College in De Pere, with us to talk about the coming political tussle to replace Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy, who announced his retirement earlier this week.